said, her voice growing strident. She took a few steps back. She wanted to turn and run, but she was frozen, her mind like an old record stuck on repeat.
Is there someone else, Christopher?
That's not the issue.
It is, for me.
It's not about you.
I'm entitled to know.
It's my business, not yours.
I won't let you humiliate me like this. I won't.
And what will you do?
She saw his face again as he'd said that, the cold sneer twisting his lip, the arrogance.
Rosemary felt cold, then hot, the spotlights blinding, the room suffocating.
I have to get out of here.
A manicured hand on hers, nails ticking her flesh.
You're Chris's wife, aren't you?
The young woman who said this reminded Rosemary of a ferret, sleek and mean-looking, shadowed eyes narrowed, a tight, insincere smile.
Yes,
Rosemary nodded.
You don't know me. Haley Patchett. I used to work at the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles.
She flipped her long red hair to the side. Rosemary took in the skin-tight dress, 6-inch heels, a dozen silver and gold bracelets at her wrist, the kind of woman she could never compete with, the kind of woman she never met back in Shaker Heights, who seemed to be standard issue in New York or L.A. or San Francisco, the kind of woman that Christopher always fell for. Rosemary just stared at her, had to control herself from lashing out.
Oh, but I do know you, and not from anything you do at the museum.
She sucked in a deep breath.
How dare you come here?
Whatever do you mean? Haley held on to her smile.
I think you should leave.
Oh, I don't think so. Haley arched one perfectly penciled brow and peered past Rosemary into the crowd, a crowd that was ripe for the picking, she thought, but not tonight. She was looking for someone specific. She looked Rosemary up and down, barked a laugh, then turned away. Rosemary's face burned as she watched Haley Patchett wiggle through the crowd like a snake. Then she caught sight of Christopher at the center of the throng, expertly juggling 6 or 7 people at once. His pretty associate, Justine Olegard, standing beside him dutifully. He was sleeping with Justine, too. She knew it.
My God, is there any woman here he hasn't?
Rosemary watched Christopher, laughing, brushing the blonde hair away from his forehead, still playing the golden boy, and felt an ache in her chest that caused her to gasp. And then that redhead, Haley Patchett, joined the group, her hand on Christopher's arm. Rosemary wished she could disappear, become invisible. But isn't that what she'd always been?
It's my time, Rosemary, and I don't need any baggage.
Was that what she was? Baggage?
I've done plenty for you, Rosemary, but it's over.
Done for me? What have you done for me? The room was thrumming. The noise, the lights, the small Jackson Pollock studies, wild splashes of brush and ink, pulsating on the white walls. Then it all seemed to stop, the clamor reduced to the slightest hum, the crowd disappearing, and it was just the three of them. Christopher and that horrid redhead spotlighted in front of the Pollock, two figures performing against a backdrop of shimmering paint, and Rosemary, watching. She couldn't hear what they were saying, but read their body language. The woman pitched forward, hip thrust out, Christopher whispering in her ear, her hand gripping his arm. But when the woman reached up to touch Christopher's hair, here, in the museum, with Rosemary watching, with everyone watching, that was it. The room was spinning around her like those Jackson Pollock drips. Rosemary knew she was moving, could hear herself mutter, "Excuse me, excuse me," as she cut through the crowd, the sound of her own breath loud in her ears, heart pounding as Christopher and that woman grew larger and clearer,
The individual strands of Christopher's blonde hair and the woman's black-red nail polish standing out in high relief while everything around them blurred. Christopher Thomas beamed at the small coterie of fans gathered around him, then looked past them, and there she was, his wife, hovering at the periphery of the crowd like a pathetic waif. He took in the light brown hair hanging limply to her shoulders, her shapeless beige dress. He'd long ago stopped seeing the pretty woman behind the plain packaging. He tried to locate his feelings for her, but couldn't.
"Hey, juggler."
Peter Hewson slapped his brother-in-law on the back.
"What? Juggler, you know."
Peter mimed the act. Christopher Thomas regarded him with disdain. Peter the blowhard. Peter the freeloader. Peter, who had his uses. Christopher patted his brother-in-law on the back and turned away.
"So, how does the pollock look to you?" Christopher asked Tony Olson.
"Shimmering. Brilliant.
Expensive."
"What about sloppy?"
said Peter Hewson, insinuating himself between the two men, slurring his words. Christopher sighed loudly.
"My brother-in-law fails to notice the internal structure that pollock is working with, the choreography of the drips, the interweaving skeins of paint, almost like a dance."
Peter made a noise through his nose, and Christopher snagged him by the elbow, turned him around fast, and hissed in his ear.
"Go away, Peter. Now. You're not even supposed to be here."
"Oh, fuck off, Thomas. I know you,"
Peter said, his boozy breath hitting Christopher's face like a damp sponge.
"Chris."
Christopher let go of his brother-in-law and turned to the familiar voice.
"I've left over a dozen messages for you," she said.
"Haley Patchett." Christopher could feel the crowd closing around him, collectors and artists, his staff, even the chief curator, his boss, Alex Hultgren, a man devoid of humor, and the chairman of the board, Tony Olson.
"I can't speak now," he whispered to Haley. "I'll call you."
"That's what you keep saying, but you never do."
"Who's this, Chris?"
Justine Olegard took a step in front of Haley Patchett.
"I could ask you the same question," said Haley, eyeing Justine, lips pursed.
Christopher looked from one to the other.
"I can't do this, Haley. Not here," he whispered close to her ear.
"Oh, you remember my name. What a surprise."
She trilled a fake laugh, and Christopher tightened a grip on her arm.
"Oh, relax," she said. "I'm not going to cause a scene." "You already have."
He looked around, saw the chief curator, Tony Olson, Justine, all watching him. Christopher painted on a smile, trying to diffuse the moment, as Haley Patchett reached up to smooth his hair, an old habit, something she'd seen in a movie, no doubt. Everything about Haley was theatrical. And he would have stopped her, the act totally inappropriate for the setting, his hand already reaching up for hers, when he saw Rosemary cutting through the crowd toward him, her features distorted with anger.
"Enough!"
Rosemary Thomas was surprised to hear her voice, so much louder than she expected. She swatted Haley Patchett's arm away from her husband.
"What on earth?"
Haley glared at her, mouth open.
"What you've done for me?"
Rosemary shouted at Christopher.
"For me?"
She was trembling, but it didn't matter. Nothing seemed to matter.
"To think what I gave up for you, the years, my life, and for what?"
"Rosemary, please."
Christopher made tamping down motions with his large hands, a smile frozen on his lips. Everyone around them had gone quiet, a ripple effect in motion, the crowd quieting in successive rings until the only people left talking were those on the outer fringe, a throbbing chorus at the museum's perimeter. Christopher reached for Rosemary, but she slapped his hand away and pulled back.
Rosemary, you bastard! I gave you all this, and now... Rosemary, please! You've had too much to drink, darling. You're not yourself.
He managed an arm around her shoulder, but she shook him off.
I've had nothing to drink. I've never been more sober.
The sound of her voice, her words, still shocked her, but she couldn't stop.
You want a divorce, Christopher? We'll see about that.
Then the room was spinning, the ceiling slanting on an oblique angle, the floor coming to meet it, and she saw Justine's eyes narrowing and Haley Patchett smiling and Tony Olson frowning, and all the artists and dealers and curators like grotesque caricatures out of a Daumier print staring at her. And then, in a moment, as if someone had thrown a switch, the room came back to life, everyone chattering but looking away, embarrassed, pretending nothing had happened. But it was too late. The reality of what she had done in the middle of the exhibition, in the middle of the museum with everyone watching, rippled through her. Tears in her eyes, cheeks burning, she pushed her way through the crowd and ran out of the room.
Chapter 5 by Sandra Brown. Mom? Her day was only 5 seconds old, and already Rosemary dreaded the remainder of it. She rolled onto her back and pried her eyes open. Her daughter was standing beside the bed, still in her pajamas, a Barbie tucked beneath her arm.
Are you awake, Mom?
Yes, honey.
Where's Daddy?
Chris's side of the bed was conspicuously empty. Rosemary cleared her throat. He had to go into work early today. It was an obvious lie, even to a child, one Rosemary had used too often. Layla looked at Rosemary with sulky reproach.
Your eyes are puffy.
Are they? Rosemary could tell by feel that they were. I slept hard. She tried to muster a smile.
Was it a nice party, Mommy?
Rosemary avoided answering.
Is your brother up? He's downstairs. We're hungry.
Ask Elsie to fix your breakfast.
We like your pancakes better, Mom.
Her daughter stood there waiting for her. Rosemary pushed off the covers and got out of bed. The events of last night would catch up with her sooner or later, but in the meantime she must act as though this were an ordinary day. For the children's sake. For her own sanity. The first indication that this might not be a normal day in the life of Rosemary Hewson Thomas came at 11 o'clock after the pancake breakfast. Her children had eaten. She had pretended to. She'd sorted dry cleaning with her maid, Elsie, asked her to schedule the window washer for one day next week, and having received a reminder postcard from the dentist, called to make appointments for her and the children. Normalcy. Getting on with the routine things of life. But then, just as she was on her way out to the garden to cut roses, Elsie approached her with a cordless house phone.
It's the museum, asking for Mr. Thomas.
Rosemary waited until Elsie was out of earshot. Hello?
Good morning, Mrs. Thomas.
It was Chris's secretary.
I hate to bother Mr. Thomas at home, she cooed. But something's come up that needs his immediate attention. May I speak with him, please?
He's not here.
Oh?
The single syllable was heavy on inflection, causing it to vibrate with implication. Rosemary's cheeks flamed with anger and resentment. But the newfound audacity she'd exhibited last night was made shyer by caution this morning. She decided she should volunteer nothing. Say as little as possible. With all the composure she could muster, she asked, "Have you tried his cell phone?"
"Numerous times. Mr. Olson is quite anxious to speak with him. Do you have any idea where I might reach him?"
I'm sorry, no.
Or when he might be available?
No.
Will you be coming in today, Mrs. Thomas?
The busybody was really rubbing it in, wasn't she? The department of the museum in which Rosemary worked wasn't any business of hers. She was fishing for information about Chris. That was all. Not today, no. Now, if you'll excuse...
You have no idea where I can find your husband?
Rosemary pretended not to have heard the question and disconnected before anything more could be said. Rosemary didn't hear the door open or even his footsteps. Her brother, the last person she needed or wanted to entertain today, breezed in uninvited. Since their childhood, he'd had a knack for tormenting her when she could least withstand it. He'd shown up just in time for cocktails, wouldn't that be nice? And her lack of enthusiasm for the idea hadn't deterred him from asking Elsie to roll out the liquor cart. Having little choice, Rosemary left Elsie in charge of seeing that the children were given their supper and joined Peter, who had made himself right at home and poured himself a drink.
"Wild horses couldn't have kept me away. I couldn't wait to see what you have planned for an encore. Throwing china at Chris's head, maybe? Driving his car into the swimming pool? I hope it's something fabulously dramatic. A drink for you, Rosie? Forgive my candor, but you look like you need a little pick-me-up."
"No, thank you. I'm surprised you're not hungover. You were well into your cups last night."
"But not so drunk that I didn't appreciate the full impact of your performance. My God, Rosie."
He raised his glass in a mock salute.
"You made me proud, standing up to Chris with past and present lovers hanging on every accusatory word, and the museum muckety-mucks looking on with their mouths agape. It was too much. Honestly, I didn't know you had it in you."
He winked.
"Makes me wonder what else you're capable of."
"Shut up, Peter," she snapped. He grinned at her over the rim of his highball glass as he sipped from it.
"Will the cheating bastard be joining us for drinks?"
"I wouldn't count on it." Peter laughed.
"What'd he have to say for himself today, now that his sins have been exposed? Has he repented, brought you flowers, an expensive piece of jewelry?"
"I haven't seen him today." Peter set his glass on the table and leaned forward.
"Really?"
He didn't come home last night."
Interesting. I wouldn't peg him as the tuck-tail type."
Peter looked at her archly.
"Of course, who could really blame him for staying away after the public dressing down you gave him? I suppose he's playing the injured party."
"Which would be like him, wouldn't it?" Peter reached for his drink again and sipped it while watching her thoughtfully.
"It's unlike you to speak ill of Chris, even knowing what a fornicating, lying, opportunistic bastard he is. You've always defended him. Until now. Why the switch?"
"He asked me for a divorce." The secret was out. Everyone had heard her. There was no point in hiding it now. "He insisted on a divorce."
"And you lost it, or so I gather by last night's scene."
"Maybe I will have a drink." She poured herself a glass of white wine and sipped from it, aware of her brother's amused gaze. She wondered if he noticed that her hands were trembling.
"Imagine Chris showing up at the museum this morning," he said around a chuckle. "How did he face the staff? Your friend Tony Olson looked ready to kill him. He's probably called an emergency meeting of the board of directors. But I'll bet he was there to greet Chris."
"Chris didn't go to work today. At least he wasn't there this morning." She told Peter about the call she'd received.
"Where do you suppose he spent the day?"
"Honestly, I don't care."
"Bunking with one of his lovers?"
Rosemary acted as though she hadn't heard.
"Perhaps making cozy with the beautiful Justine."
Justine. Rosemary's blood turned hot when she thought of Chris's latest conquest. Everyone at the museum knew he had taken Justine on his most recent trip to France. She was the latest in a long line of pretty curators singled out for special attention by him. Peter continued with his speculation.
Or maybe he's with that red-headed bitch, the one with the long fingernails who was draping herself over him last night when you made your move.
They deserve each other, Rosemary mumbled. Then rousing herself, she said, I don't know where he is, only that I haven't seen him since I left the museum last night.
As for the state of your marriage...
Tears filled her eyes. My children, she said hoarsely. This will be awful for them. Peter linked his hands and turned them inside out high above his head, stretching luxuriantly.
Ah, well, he said on a sigh. Maybe you won't have to worry about the messiness of a divorce. Maybe Chris's other sins have also caught up with him.
She wiped her eyes. What other sins?
Come now, Rosemary. You can't be that naive. If he breaks his wedding vows, do you really believe he would be true blue to other covenants?
What are you talking about? Peter brushed a non-existent piece of lint off the leg of his trousers.
It's not for me to say. Maybe you should ask Stan.
Stan Ballard, their lawyer and estate manager. What would he know that I don't? Rosemary could tell by her brother's sly grin that he was itching to tell.
Remember Chris's recently broken finger?
She nodded.
He didn't get it by slamming the car door on it, as he claimed.
Peter's gaze wandered to the Golden Gate Bridge, which was shrouded in fog. He smirked.
If Chris doesn't turn up soon, maybe someone should drag the bay for his body.
At the San Francisco Police Department, Detective Joe Nunn's cell phone rang. It was Tony Olson.
Mr. Olson, what...
I thought we were past that Mr. Olson business.
They'd known each other for a few years now, but for some reason, Joe Nunn could only think of Tony Olson as Mr. Olson. But he humored him now.
All right, Tony. It's been a while. What's up?
Do you remember the McFall Art Museum?
Of course,
Nunn said, remembering all too well the awkward hours he'd spent there like a fish out of water. Olson had enlisted Nunn and his wife Sarah for a charity event at the McFall, the museum's feeble attempt to give back to the community by establishing summer programs to keep kids likely to commit crimes off the streets. Olson said the exposure would be great PR for Nunn's career, and he felt safer having Nunn and a couple of other cops in attendance while inviting a shady element indoors. Sarah jumped at the chance and enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, you know I'm on the museum's board. Chairman, in fact.
Olson paused.
Something's come up that I was hoping you could help me with.
Sure, Tony.
Nunn was thinking the theft of a valuable painting. Vandalism, maybe.
It concerns Christopher Thomas, one of our curators.
Nunn remembered the name. How could he forget with the way Thomas had ogled his wife and every other attractive woman at the fundraiser?
He hasn't been seen in a week. It seems he's gone missing.
Recognizing the seriousness in the older man's voice, Nunn stepped into his cubicle to help block out the ambient noise in the violent crimes unit, where detectives who weren't actively detecting were talking on their phones or bullshitting with each other. Nunn listened as Tony Olson described an ugly scene that had taken place between Christopher and Rosemary Thomas at a black tie museum function a week earlier.
According to the staff, he didn't report to work the following day, which was understandable, Olson said. Everyone in the hall had overheard the confrontation. It was believed he was embarrassed and needed some time to sort things out with Rosemary.
That's the wife?
Yes. She's a dear friend of mine. She also works at the museum. A valued employee, a very knowledgeable woman.
But they had issues?
Well, his affairs have been no secret, Olson said scornfully. He's not a particularly nice guy, John. He and I have had our differences.
Then why are you concerned?
He's disappeared. He hasn't been seen since that night. Rosemary had her say, then ran from the hall. Chris excused himself and followed her out. That's the last anyone saw of him.
None thought a moment.
Has she reported him missing?
She's gone to Mexico.
What? No, it's not what you're thinking. She went on behalf of the museum. There's an exhibit in Mexico City, Spanish armaments from the conquest. She oversees the arms and armor department of the museum, so she went to check it out.
Just like that?
She's been in conversation with the museum down there for some time. But yes, her decision to go seemed rather sudden. Though I encouraged it, she was still very upset over what she called making a fool of myself at the Pollock event. If you ask me, the SOB had it coming to him, and more, for a long time. I told her a few days away would do her good.
Is she aware that no one's seen her husband since she told him off?
She acknowledged that he didn't come home the night of the incident, but she wasn't that worried about it. I'm assuming it wasn't unusual for Chris to spend a night out. Certainly since she had brought his philandering into the open, it wasn't surprising that he didn't go home.
None mulled it over.
So, no one's actually reported him missing?
No.
I'm in homicide, Tony. I realize that, but I hope to get your read on it before getting the police officially involved. There's no love lost between Chris Thomas and me, but I'd hate for Rosemary's heartache to be made public, more so than it's already been, not to mention the museum's reputation. The board's concern is safeguarding that.
I get it. Donors wouldn't appreciate a scandal involving museum personnel. But marital problems are marital problems, Tony. Common and not that scandalous.
After a slight hesitation, Tony said, I suspect that Chris's extracurricular activities may have extended beyond unfaithfulness to his wife.
Care to expand on that?
There was a pause. Then Olson said,
Not until I have to.
Well, can you venture a guess where he might be? After 5 days, when he still hadn't come to work, the museum staff came to me. Things were stacking up. Issues needed his attention. Beyond that, they were concerned for his well-being. I called Rosemary at her hotel in Mexico. She still hadn't had any contact with him. She said if I wanted to find him, I should talk to one of his girlfriends.
What exactly is it you're asking me to do, Tony?
To look into it. His disappearance. You're the only policeman I know personally, and I know I can trust you to be discreet.
I understand, but if he doesn't turn up soon, I know.
They talked a few more minutes. None promised to be back in touch soon. He would put out feelers, interview the girlfriends, do some snooping, and it would probably result in his locating Christopher Thomas sunning himself on a private beach with one of his babes, her ass in one hand, a tropical drink in the other. But a week after None's initial conversation with Tony Olson, there'd been numerous conversations since. He was waiting outside customs when Rosemary Thomas re-entered the United States. She looked bedraggled as she pulled her suitcase behind her. None placed himself in her path.
Rosemary Thomas?
Yes.
My name's John None. He presented her his badge. I'd like to talk to you about the disappearance of your husband, Christopher Thomas.
Chapter 6 by Faye Kellerman. If anything had taught her patience, it had been the past couple of weeks. Ostensibly, the trip to Mexico was a chance for her to eye a magnificent collection of colonial Spanish armor. But the real reason for the sudden departure was to give Rosemary something that she'd sorely been lacking for years. Perspective. She gave the intruder a quick once-over with a cool eye. His jacket was a size too small and a couple of years out of fashion. His hair appeared as if it had been styled by a nearsighted barber, and he was in need of a shave. His mouth was thin, his nose too long, but he was attractive and looked intelligent. "Who are you?" Again, Nunn presented his shield, but she shrugged. "I know a dozen artisans who could forge that for $5 or less." She started walking, her suitcase in tow. "Act tough," she told herself. "Leave me the hell alone." Nunn had to do a two-step to keep pace with her. "Could I talk to you for a minute?" "Not for a second." She stopped and glared at him. "How dare you come to me with your badge and your insinuations?"
"I don't remember any insinuation, ma'am."
Rosemary kept walking, but Nunn dogged her heels. She slung a large purse over her shoulder, almost clipping his face.
"Your husband's missing."
"Oh?"
"That doesn't concern you?"
Rosemary swallowed.
"My husband's business is not my business."
"Really?"
Nunn tried to look her in the eye. Impossible.
2 weeks ago it might have been, but not now. Christopher told me in no uncertain terms that I was a blight on him, both professionally and personally, so why should I give a damn about him?
Rosemary took a deep breath, then another.
"I don't know where he is, and I don't care."
She reached the automatic doors, and when they opened, she stepped outside. The traffic was thick and the noise deafening. She debated jaywalking to get rid of the cop, but decided it wasn't worth the risk. She found the crosswalk and waited for the light to turn green.
"Please, just go away."
"I hear you two fought. What else?"
Rosemary kept up the false bravado, though her head was starting to pound.
"If you're a detective, you should know."
"Okay, let me tell you what I do know. Your husband had demanded a divorce, and that night you had a meltdown."
"And?"
"And then you fought, publicly."
"Silly ninny that I was. I made a complete ass out of myself."
She tried to smile. The light changed to green, and, suitcase in tow, she started across the four-lane roadway.
"And for what? For some pompous, adulterous, priggish twit who has been using me, or more to the point, my money, for umpteen years? God, I detest that man," she said, though a part of her ached when she said it.
When she got to the other side of the street, she ducked into the parking structure, took a deep breath, picked up her pace, and Nunn had no choice but to follow.
"And you have no idea where he is?"
"No, nor am I concerned that he's missing. If God is half as benevolent as the preachers claim he is, he'll make good and sure he stays missing."
Rosemary stopped and turned on Nunn until they were almost nose to nose. She wanted to run, but she stood fast.
"Have I made myself clear, officer?"
"Like it or not, Mrs. Thomas, you're going to have to deal with the situation."
"I told you, Christopher Thomas is no longer my business."
"I'm afraid he is."
Nunn looked into the woman's eyes, which were pale blue and sad. He didn't buy her tough gal act.
"How about we go for a cup of coffee and discuss this?"
"Look, mister, I..."
"It's Detective John Nunn, SFPD, homicide."
She eyed him once again.
"Why in the world would I want to talk to you?"
"I'm here because I had my arm twisted by a friend of mine, and yours."
"Whose name is?"
"Tony Olson."
He studied her face as her eyes widened.
"And he's worried about your husband."
"Well, I'm not.
You're not the least bit concerned that your husband has vanished?
Vanished is a rather strong word.
It's an applicable word, Mrs. Thomas. No one has heard from him in 2 weeks. He hasn't shown up at work. He isn't answering his calls. His cell phone mailbox is full. Emails sent to him go unanswered. Rosemary bit her lower lip.
I don't know where he is, Detective. I'm sorry, but I can't help you.
You were the last person to see him alive.
Are you threatening me again?
Just stating an obvious fact, Mrs. Thomas. Everyone at the museum, at the Jackson Pollock event, saw you run out of the room. And everyone there also saw your husband run after you. And no one, and I mean no one, has heard from your husband since. And I know that because I've interviewed every one of them, except you. None let that sink in. Right now, you've got a chance to talk to me unofficially. How long that'll last? He shrugged. Rosemary swallowed hard.
How do you know Tony?
We go way back. It's complicated. He took the handle of her suitcase. Where's your car? She grabbed her suitcase back from him.
This is none of your business.
Last chance, Mrs. Thomas. Official or unofficial? Rosemary didn't speak for a moment. Then, finally, she said,
There's a coffee shop about 5 minutes away. 10 blocks to the north. I'll meet you there.
The woman had been described to Nan as mousy and meek, but from his first impression, he'd have to say she was anything but. Still, he felt it was an act, a bruised woman acting tough. And she was good-looking, not exactly a knockout, but her sad blue eyes were beautiful, and she had a dynamite figure he hadn't missed, and a tan, courtesy of her sojourn in Mexico. He liked that she looked him squarely in the face when she talked to him, her eyes trying not to betray her vulnerability. She was nothing like the suspects he was used to dealing with.
Olson, what'd you get me into?
She arrived 5 minutes after he did and slid into the red Naugahyde bench seat opposite. She hid her face behind a plastic menu. Nunn studied the list of food items, typical coffee shop fare. The place was staffed with hair-netted waitresses in white, fluffy skirts and white aprons. He said, What can I get you?
Peace and quiet.
Nan laughed. She put the menu down.
I'm not hungry and the greasy smell is making me ill. Just get your questions over with, please.
Hey, you picked the place, not me.
I'm noted for picking losers.
Rosemary tried to smile, but her eyes filled with tears. After a moment, she said,
I'm usually not a bitch. Christopher was the nasty one. Now that he's gone, I suppose I've discovered the wicked side of myself.
Now that he's gone?
Gone as in gone from my life, not gone for good.
Rosemary dried her eyes on a paper napkin.
See, this is precisely why I didn't want to talk to you. I say one thing and you've warped it into an accusation.
Look, Mrs. Thomas, I don't know what happened to your husband, but if something did happen, this little interview is only going to be a dress rehearsal. So in reality, I'm doing you a favor. Rosemary stiffened again.
Am I supposed to be thankful?
You can continue with your snide comments, or we can work together to figure out what's happened to your husband.
You see, here's where we differ. I don't care. Christopher stepped out of my life that awful night, and I'm glad.
She straightened her shoulders to emphasize what she'd said. So what happened that awful night?
You're the one with the facts. You tell me.
You stormed out of the gallery, and Christopher followed you. People heard you argue, slinging accusations at one another. Rosemary said,
I told him he was pathetic, and he told me I was frigid. But what really infuriated me was his calling me an albatross around his neck, as if I was a liability. It was my money and my devotion to his career that made him what he was.
That must have really angered you.
I already said that.
She paused.
So now you're playing shrink?
Nunn smiled as a waitress came over to take their order. Rosemary surprised him by ordering a hamburger with all the fixings, a double order of French fries, and a Coke. He ordered coffee, black. What happened after you argued?
I went home, detective. I don't know what Christopher did, and I don't care.
Nunn gave her a chance to add to her story. When she didn't speak, he said, Aren't you leaving something out?
Yes, I forgot to tell you that I absolutely loathe the bastard.
Nunn dropped his voice. Mrs. Thomas, I told you. I've talked to people, all sorts of people. I know you went home, eventually. He leaned back in the booth and saw the panic in her eyes. I spoke to the guards. You two weren't very discreet. They heard the both of you arguing. He leaned forward and dropped his voice to a whisper. Why don't you get it off your chest? Tell me about it. Rosemary stared at a worn spot on the formica tabletop.
There's nothing to tell.
You did go back to the museum.
I went back to my office to get some peace and quiet. I was...
Her eyes watered again.
I was so ashamed of my behavior.
Nunn nodded sympathetically. In the back of his mind, he was cursing himself for not bringing her into the station house, for not formally Mirandizing her. But now that she was talking, he didn't want to interrupt.
I couldn't believe how low I had sunk.
She looked up at Nunn.
Why should I care if we divorced? We hadn't been a real couple in ages. I was angry. I was spiteful. I was sick. After arguing outside the event, I knew that if I didn't leave, I'd do something I really regretted. So I got in my car and drove away from him. I couldn't possibly go home, not in my condition, so I turned around.
And went back to the museum? To your office? She nodded.
But Christopher, being Christopher, couldn't leave it alone. He had to torture me. He had to make sure that he had the last word.
He followed you.
He couldn't leave it alone,
she said, a bit breathless. He came to your office?
My first mistake was thinking that we could actually have a civil conversation.
He was mad.
He was irate.
She sighed.
My head had cleared. Somewhat. I replayed that horrid scene in my head and decided that, above all, I wasn't going to stoop to his childish level of hurling barbs and insults. Our marriage was over, and the sooner I accepted it, the happier I would be.
She studied Nunn's face.
One of the reasons I went to Mexico. It was time to be good to myself, to discover the old Rosemary, the one who probably attracted Christopher in the first place.
What happened when he followed you into your office?
We argued. I threw things, he threw things. It was loud and embarrassing. One of the guards came in to investigate. At that point, I was so flustered I just picked up my purse and left.
She locked on his eyes.
He now noticed flecks of silver amid the blue, like diamond dust. They were beautiful. That was the last time I saw him.
She almost smiled.
And what an image it was! His beet-red, sweaty face, his snarled mouth, his shaking hands. He looked like a gargoyle.
A sad laugh.
I've carried that image with me. Every time I think about the upcoming divorce and I get scared, I just picture that face. It calms me down.
She bit her lower lip.
And he was alive when I left him, detective. Alive.
That might have been true, but Nunn had already caught her in a lie. Although the guard had gone in to investigate, he never said anything about her leaving. As a matter of fact, the guard distinctly remembered Rosemary smiling, telling him that they just had a little marital tiff. But Nunn didn't want to confront her. Not yet. Nunn looked at the woman sitting across from him.
I need a favor from you.
Rosemary looked up but didn't speak.
I need you to come down to the station house and give a statement. It'll clear up everything, and then I won't have to bother you again.
Why should I do that?
But why wouldn't you want to do that? Nunn asked.
clear up this business and your name.
I never realized that my name was sullied.
It's just a simple statement.
Once you put things in writing, it's never simple.
None could see that she wasn't going to fold that easily. Hey, you walked out of your office, so technically the guard was the last man to see Christopher alive.
Exactly, Rosemary told him. So talk to him.
Her hamburger came. Rosemary picked up a French fry, but then let it fall on her plate.
I don't know why I ordered this.
She pushed her plate aside. Her eyes darkened and she stood up.
I'm leaving.
Nunn dropped a 20 on the table and followed her outside.
Mrs. Thomas, wait!
But she didn't stop. When she got to her car, she couldn't unlock the door. Her hands were shaking too hard. Tears streamed down her cheeks. She dropped her keys and buried her face in her hands.
Please, just go away.
Nunn tried to make his voice as soothing as he could.
I can go away, Mrs. Thomas, but what happened isn't going to go away. It's never going to go away until we find your husband.
So go look for him and stop bothering me.
She was sobbing by this point. Nunn picked up her car keys and placed them in his pocket. You're way too upset to drive. Her hands slowly peeled from her face.
Please, please leave me alone.
Nunn placed his hand on her shoulder.
Make it easy on yourself. Let me take you down to the station house so you can get all of this off your chest.
I told you everything.
I know you did, Nunn said calmly.
You were very forthright. And that's good. All I need from you is a written statement of what you told me. That's it. Simple.
Nothing in life is simple, she said,
her face suddenly older. Look, once I get a statement from you, I get Tony off my back, I get my superiors off my back, and that's that.
I may be the jilted wife, but I'm not a moron, detective.
I can see that. But it doesn't have to be complicated. Nunn's brain was obsessing on a single thought, how to get her voluntarily into the interview room. Look, forget about the statement. Don't write anything down. You come down to the station house and we'll talk.
That's all. Just you and me. We'll talk. What do you say?
Rosemary dried her tears on her shirt sleeve and took a deep breath. Nunn waited for a response, but when she said nothing, he gently took her elbow and guided her to his waiting car.
Diary of John Nunn by Andrew F. Gooley. Once she stepped into the interview room, that look in her eyes seemed to tell me how it was going to go. Rosemary gave her statement. Unlike our talk in the coffee shop, her voice now shook. She second-guessed and contradicted herself even more than she had earlier. But any cop will tell you the innocent are never consistent. It's the ones who look you in the eye without blinking. Say their piece as if they're reading from a script. They're the ones you have to watch out for. I couldn't help liking her. She was nothing like the suspects I'd dealt with before. At times I wanted to help her along, help clarify things. But it was useless. The wheels were turning in one direction, and I had to be an unwilling participant. God, yeah. God should bless those suckers who go against the tide and get crushed. I never did back then, and look where I am now. After she finished giving her statement, she got up from the gray institutional chair and smoothed out her skirt. She didn't belong in that dingy office. I drove her back to the coffee shop, so that she could get her car and gave her the line about calling me if anything came up. She called 3 days later asking if there were any leads. I used that as an excuse to see her. I told myself I was just doing police work, and I was. But as I got deeper into the case in the days and weeks that followed, I realized that I liked being around her, even if her story didn't add up. I'll never forget that day, bright and sunny, the kind of day when even as a cop you felt nothing bad could happen. Sarah and I woke up at the same time.
Something bothering you? She asked.
After 10 years of marriage, she could tell by how I stirred when I was sleeping if I was struggling with something. No, just this museum case. I stretched out my arms. No body or blood yet, but when he does turn up, he won't look pretty. Sarah was surprised. I hardly ever talked about my cases and rarely expressed my opinions. I'd always prided myself on keeping my cool cop distance. But something about the Thomas case had gotten to me. Sarah could see it had become personal even though I denied it. "You sure you're not going to find this guy on the Riviera with a case of convenient amnesia?" she asked, getting out of bed. "I don't think he's coming back alive." His wife must have done it. Sarah was never the judgmental type, so I was surprised. I watched her as she walked over to the window and pulled open the curtains. "What makes you think that?" I sat up in bed. She turned around to face me. The plain wife married to the dashing, philandering husband, who married her for her money and status, decides she's had enough one day and kills him. "How do you know all that about him?" She smiled. "You've only told me all that a million times." She walked back to the bed, got in and snuggled up next to me. "This is your chance to shine, John. Our dreams may come true if a high-profile case you're working on goes to court. You can retire, write a book. The whole world will be yours." I wished she had said something else. On my way back home from work that day, I stopped at Rosemary's house. I wanted to see her, though I couldn't tell you why or what I was planning to say. Part of me wanted her to crumble completely, admit everything, and that would be it. But I knew that if and when she did, I'd feel dirtied up by the whole thing. Even if she did kill him, I'd hate the part I'd played in bringing about her demise. The maid showed me in, and as I was walking into that palatial living room of hers, I heard a man's voice.
"It was only a matter of time before the big boys got him." It was some guy with long hair, a scraggly beard and dark, intense eyes. He was sitting on the sofa, scotch in hand, very much at home. Rosemary turned, studying my face, looking for a sign that might betray why I was there. I didn't have much to say, so she smiled and said,
"I'd like you to meet Hank Zacharias."
I had heard of Zacharias, the investigative reporter. He'd been a thorn in the side of the SFPD ever since he'd uncovered some kind of corruption involving higher-ups at the department.
"John Nunn," I said.
He stared at me as if trying to assess what I was all about, then gave me a loose handshake, kissed Rosemary's cheek, and left. I looked around the place, living room big enough to fit my apartment 4 times. The marble this and marble that, the cut glass chandeliers, expensive art on the walls, the swimming pool I glimpsed through the French doors. The kind of place that would make Sarah happy. Although the woman to whom all this belonged was anything but. She sat back down on the couch after Zacharias left and was looking up at me, almost questioningly. Her face had grown thinner since our first meeting, and her eyes seemed to have grown larger, prettier.
"Who are the big boys, Rosemary?"
"Oh, you know Hank Zacharias. He's into that stuff. He has his theories." She paused.
"So why are you here? Is there any news?"
"No, nothing. I suddenly felt awkward at being there. I guess I just wanted to check up on you." Her face reddened.
"I've told you all I know, Detective."
I walked over to the window and looked down at the tree-lined valley. I thought of Christopher Thomas standing where I now stood. Nothing was enough for him, the money, the wife, the power. Some people's appetites could never be satisfied. What a bastard. I wouldn't blame her if she did kill him. Something in me stirred. The big boys. Zacharias and his clichés. I walked back to the sofa and sat down across from her. "Rosemary, I need you to level with me."
I have leveled with you. She looked steadily into my eyes. You have to tell me whatever you know about your husband's shady dealings. She wouldn't budge. You really need to leave right now. My lawyer told me that I shouldn't even be talking to you. Look, it's probably only going to get worse after this. You're the main suspect in his disappearance. The chance of him turning up alive is zero. You have to give me some information that'll point the police in another direction. Take the spotlight away from you. This is no time to be worrying about protecting the family name. She sighed. I guess there were rumors about forgeries, about drugs. He knew about the rumors. He thought they were funny. I never took any of them seriously. The sky had started to darken. What was Zacharias? Rosemary looked up behind me. I turned. The maid had come in. Behind her were two guys I recognized from the department. Gregera and Swanson. What is it? I asked. For some reason, I had thought they'd come to talk to me. But no, it was Rosemary they were looking at. I turned to her. I'll never forget the look in her eyes. Gregera said, Rosemary Thomas, I have a warrant for your arrest.
Chapter 7 by Jonathan Santlofer. Joseph Arthur Kroger hated the summer. Not just the heat, but the attitude it seemed to foster, the total lack of professionalism among his museum employees. As if the warm weather were not only an excuse to play, but justification to drop all responsibility. Each year he knew half his staff would be vacationing at one European shoreline or another, although he didn't know which and didn't care. The German Historical Museum of Berlin was his only concern since taking over as director nearly two decades earlier. An academic by training, and some said by nature, Kroger believed in hard work and routine. Today, as every other day, he'd left his flat in Mitte, on Upper Friedrichstrasse at exactly 8:12, had taken the U-Bahn to Museumsinsel, and had arrived at the museum at 9 sharp. He spent only 6 minutes, rather than his usual 10, reviewing his daily calendar when he realized the crate from America was still languishing in a basement workroom and had been for a week. That was it. Enough, infuriating, that one of his prized objects, and one of the most popular with the museum's visitors, should be sitting in a dank workroom, galled him. Kroger reached for his phone, then realized the museum installers were, like just about everyone else, on vacation. The hallway leading to the basement storeroom was hot, the consequence of turning off the museum's air conditioning at night, an energy-saving effort that Kroger disapproved of despite the board vote, and particularly irritating at the moment with his starched white shirt already sticking to his thick upper body. He was sorry he'd loaned the Iron Maiden to the American Museum in the first place, and would not have if the curator hadn't persisted in a letter-writing campaign that culminated in her calling and pleading, insisting it would be the centerpiece of an exhibition devoted to savage torture devices, and, in her polite though forthright manner, convincing him. Unlike most of the American curators Kroger dealt with, who acted as if they were entitled to anything and everything, Rosemary Thomas had been a velvet steamroller, as genteel as she was persuasive. And, good to her word, her exhibition at the McFall Art Museum had garnered serious press, which had credited his museum with the loan, and so perhaps it had not been a bad idea, though right now he was anxious to get it back on display. The workroom felt like a tomb, no sign or sense of a human presence among the multi-sized crates and art objects awaiting repair, tools strewn along a work table, sawdust on the floor, more suspended in the hot, sticky air. Kruger snorted with disgust.